Finally, if you can stand it, I'd like to be the 10,000th person to have a word about the actor Charlie Sheen and what appears to be some kind of major breakdown being acted out on multiple media platforms over the last couple of weeks. The broad outlines, in case you missed it, he is the star of what is or has been the country's most popular network sitcom, Two and a Half Men, which airs on CBS. Because of that show, he is said to be the highest paid actor working in television right now. But he's also been in and out of the tabloids for some time for his disturbing and sometimes violent behavior involving his two ex-wives, as well as prostitutes and porn stars. There's also been lots of alcohol and drugs, at least until recently, and his rants have been taking place on bigger and bigger media platforms. Here's a sample of what we've been hearing from an interview on NBC.
I'm tired of pretending like I'm not special. I'm tired of pretending like I'm not bitching a total freaking rock star from Mars, and people can't figure me out. They can't process me. I don't expect them to. You can't process me with a normal brain.
Now, a lot of people, most especially, but not exclusively, those of us in the media, have been feeding on and repulsed by the story in almost equal measure. You can see why. The story has everything. He's a famous actor from a famous family. He's rich, sort of good-looking, and he's putting his business all out in the street. When asked why he had a thing for women who make their living in porn, he allowed as to how he is the best at what he does, and so are they. As the Washington Post's Ruth Marcus put it, it's the same impulse we have to slow down at an accident scene. And Marcus went on to say the decent thing to do would be to avert our eyes and hope he gets help. Can I just tell you, I beg to differ. We are fascinated with Sheen because he is us, or rather, he is what some of us already are and will be. Celebrities, for all their outlandish behavior, are often the bellwethers for what is next for the rest of us. Even as we tut 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 about it, we are all taking notes. Over-the-top, crazy, expensive weddings? Those used to be the exclusive province of royalty and the very rich. Now, as any advice columnist or wedding planner will tell you, they are considered almost the birthright of the children of the middle class, as evidenced by the fact that wedding planning as a profession even exists. Ditto designer clothing and cosmetic surgery, and yes, the quickie divorce. It used to be that only celebrities could dissolve their marriages with dispatch. While divorce remains emotionally traumatic, it is no longer the expensive and protracted proposition that probably kept many families at least legally intact, even if the emotional ties were broken. In fact, alternative family arrangements are probably the area where celebrities have been out front, not least because of their resources. When megastar Michael Jackson married the former dental assistant Debbie Rowe, it was clearly an arrangement meant to provide him with biological children, except that nobody knew to call it what it was, a surrogacy arrangement. Yet a little over a decade later, when Ricky Martin hired a surrogate to deliver his twins, he not only did not need to hide the arrangement, he talked about it openly, as have parents who are not famous. The taboo was broken. So, too, Michael Jackson struggles with racial and gender identity. While his skin color transformation was apparently caused by a medical condition called vitiligo, it still seems clear that he had the desire to live across boundaries of race and gender in a way that many people who are not famous also want to do, whether through dress, by going online as an alternate identity, or simply refusing to be circumscribed by traditional gender norms. Back to Charlie Sheen, I don't know whether he has an ongoing substance abuse or mental health issue, but if he does, he is not alone. And I know this, he is not the first and will not be the last person to want to tell his boss to stuff it. He will not, in these times when loyalty to employees is all but non-existent, be the last to point out inconveniently that however much he is being paid, his bosses are making that much more from the fruits of his labor. He will not be the last to believe, as many people seem to think in many other fields of endeavor, that he can do whatever he wants, sexually, financially, to other people's retirement accounts, as long as he's bringing in the cash. And while I personally don't think his behavior is healthy for his five kids to witness, is it any worse than seeing your parents humiliated by long-term unemployment? But a million people aren't tweeting about that, are they? Years from now, mark my words, we'll have seminars on how to manage people who are, as he put it,
winning.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
And the show goes on at American Idol, despite the loss of its biggest star, Judge Simon Cowell. It stayed at the top of the TV ratings, with some 25 million viewers watching last week. Back in January, when the new season started, Idol's continued success was not a given. And critic Eric Deggans is going to be watching carefully when the finalists perform tomorrow.
This is American Idol.
Fans know American Idol's big performance shows are where the rubber meets the road for the singers and the judges. It's where beloved comic Ellen DeGeneres crashed and burned last year uncomfortable as a critic and uneasy around her fellow judges. Producers responded this year with an aggressive reboot. They deplored the glamour of Jennifer Lopez and the mojo of Aerosmith singer Steven Tyler.
Stacey Abrams, man, you are in your mind good and out of your mind unreal.
Girl, Tyler in particular has become Idol's new goofy mascot.
Lauren, that was spectacular. It's like Lauren Turner meets Lauren Turner. That's what it sounds like to me.
He often lights up the screen with a much-needed shot of unpredictable fun, without any of the brittle dysfunction of former judge Paula Abdul. Listen to him disagree with veteran judge Randy Jackson as they quibble over one singer's version of Alicia Keys' song, Fallen.
Steven, you know what, man? I didn't hear that at all. I heard just the right amount of style, just the right amount of sexy. If I agreed with you, we'd both be wrong.
What?
It's also obvious Idol's new crop of singers is better. It's an unexpected challenge for judges who struggle for new ways to say you done good. Pop diva Jennifer Lopez must really believe the best singing comes from inside, because she tells that to most every contestant in one way or another.
It's just natural. It's good. You're born to sing country music. Every move you make comes from something inside, but you do it so naturally. It's insane.
Even Tyler can sound a bit repetitive on that score.
That's a beautiful thing.
Thank you, babe.
We found one.
That's right.
That was beautiful. You did it.
Thank you so much.
That was a beautiful thing, Robbie.
Thank you so much.
But to be fair, sometimes Randy Jackson says the same things because the singers keep making the same mistakes. His pet peeve? Singing a song without bringing anything new. He scolded Jordan Dorsey for aping Usher.
If you're going to sing anybody else's song, you have to bring something to it that is different.
Then he dinged Tim Halperin for channeling Rob Thomas.
And I mean, you didn't, once again, bring anything different or exciting or new to it.
And Julie Zerilla, she got served for her thin copy of Idol winner Kelly Clarkson.
I love that song, but once again, you didn't bring anything different or new to it.
As Idol whittles down its 13 finalists to one winner, there's one wild card left, the voters. For years, critics have assumed the show's tween voters weed out women and people of color, leaving cute, unassuming white guys on top. Last week's results were a troubling sign. Rod Stewart clone Paul McDonald and fuzzy-faced Casey Abrams beat out better male voices. And it didn't hurt that they got a lot of compliments from the judges for their appeal to the ladies. Still, with ratings on a par with last season and an exciting crop of new talent, it's official. American Idol has saved itself from the dustbin of TV history. Now all the judges have to do is find a new way to say it.
Eric Deggans is the TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. Time now for our new segment dedicated to those of you who prefer your movies without the multiplex. Every week, lots of feature films, documentaries, and TV shows make their way onto video. So we've asked Bob Mondello to help us sort out the good from the bad. Bob's recommendation this week, a new box set of the Dragon Tattoo trilogy.
No guy who terrorizes women would ever want to meet Lisbeth Salander, the girl with the dragon tattoo. The girl who played with fire. The girl who kicked the hornet's nest. She's a girl, shall we say, of few words, every one of them choice. Lisbeth is fierce and avenging, leather-clad, rape survivor slash computer hacker slash amateur detective. She's played on screen by Noomi Rapace in a series based on Stieg Larsson's gazillion-selling Millennium novels. The first movie adaptation was designed as a film. The other two were international hits, too, but they were designed for Swedish TV. On the big screen, that was a drawback, but it means they play just fine on video. The new box set has Lisbeth sleuthing in the original Swedish. and also dubbed.
What if it's a code?
For those who just can't bear to take their eyes off Noomi Rapace, extras include a documentary about the author, as well as interviews, including one with a leading lady who, considering her screen persona, is almost disconcertingly cute and chatty.
Did you immediately see yourself in the role?
Yeah, but I always do. So, you know, I can read about, you know, a middle-aged man and I see myself in a way.
Having been passed over for the American remakes, Rapace will soon co-star with Robert Downey Jr. in his next Sherlock Holmes mystery. But for anyone who watches this boxed set, it'll be hard to forget her as a girl with a dragon tattoo who plays with fire and kicks the hell out of hornets' nests. I'm Bob Mondello.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Next year's football season is still up in the air because of the ongoing contract dispute between the NFL and its players. But those players and their stories are still a big part of our lives. And now we hear the powerful story of a football star who lived part of his childhood in shelters, in cars, and scrounging for a little bit of food and a little bit of hope.
And with the 23rd pick in the 2009 NFL draft, the Baltimore Ravens select Michael Orr, offensive tackle, Mississippi.
Now, many of us think we know Michael Orr's story from the hit 2009 film titled The Blind Side and the best-selling book upon which it is based. Both tell how Michael, a poor black kid from Memphis, was taken in by a wealthy white family who then helped him to succeed in the classroom and on the football field. But Michael Orr says there is more to tell. So there's his new book, just out, called I Beat the Odds, From Homelessness to the Blind Side and Beyond, written with sports journalist Don Yeager. And Michael Orr is with us now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Now, it's interesting because the book is dedicated to the Tuohy family, whose story with you is told in The Blind Side. But you are also very clear that you wanted to put your own stamp on the story, that you wanted to tell your story in your words. So can I just ask, is there something about the way your story was told in The Blind Side that's just making you nuts?
It's nothing, you know, correcting The Blind Side or, you know, to tell people that this is true or this is false. I really enjoyed it. It sent off a great message. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I started to understand that, you know, I am a role model. And I started to get hundreds and thousands of letters from people, you know, really across the world and telling me, you know, how I inspired them. And they were in my shoes. I was in their shoes. And I helped them change their life around and, you know, things like that. And I just said to myself, I might as well go ahead and do it. I can change so many lives and, you know, open the doors for so many people and, you know, just helping them out. So, you know, that's the reason I wrote it.
It's a very graphic description of the very difficult circumstances that you were in. But you also make a point again and again in the book that, you know, this isn't just your story, but that there are a lot of kids in that situation. I did want to ask if you feel comfortable talking about the vagaries of it, just the uncertainty of it. You know, what was the hardest part, you know, for you?
The hardest part for me, you know, living day to day, you know, going through a lot of, you know, the things that I went through, not having a steady roof over our head and not knowing, you know, where your next meal was going to come from. At the age of 7, you know, watching my little brother and little sisters being taken away by the, you know, Department of Human Services, and me and my brothers watching from a distance. We couldn't do anything about it. Just things like that on a regular basis. And, you know, but, you know, it helped me be the person I am and today, and, you know, I wouldn't be here without it.
You say that you're not poor if you know where your next meal is coming from. That's one of the first lessons I learned growing up. The lines were pretty clear. There were people who had food and there were people who had to scrounge most of the time, way more than most of the time. I was in the second group. And you also talk about how, like, now when you see people who are homeless or on the street, you always try to give them something because you remember what it felt like. And I'm wondering if you think that, do you really think that most people have any idea of what it's like to be poor in this country?
A lot of people, you know, have an idea. Way more. I think we have the power, you know, in America to, you know, change that dramatically. And for some reason, it continues to be a problem. know, that's why I go back into the, you know, the inner city, the schools, the boys and girls clubs, things like that, just to let people know that, you know, it is possible. I didn't have to necessarily have to be taken in by a wealthy family to, you know, make it. You know, the NFL, the NBA, you know, sports, I didn't have to go into sports. I could have had two or three jobs working minimum wage as long as I had a roof over my head and, you know, food on my table, decent clothes on my back every day, and not being caught up in the cycle of growing up, dropping out of school, you know, getting involved in the gangs, the drugs, and the violence. You know, that was successful for me. Everything now is really a bonus.
You write in the book, you say, for me, it wasn't about the money or the flashy lifestyle or the power. If I had wanted that, I could easily have joined the Vice Lords or Gangster Disciples. And with my size, I probably would have climbed up the ranks as a bodyguard and started bringing in the money quickly. But it was a whole different way of living that I was after. So I chose to take the other route. And I want to say that one of the things that struck me when reading the book, and that also other people commented on, so this isn't exactly an original, you know, thought of mine, is that one of the things you want to make clear is that you were very active in your own fate. In the movie, and I don't know if you agree or disagree with this, there were ways in which your character was portrayed as very passive, kind of things just happened. But one of the points you want to make is that you were choosing, and that no matter what route you took, you were going to find a way out of those circumstances.
Yeah, everything you know, you saw in the movie, it definitely made the role easier for me. You know, I always understood the game of football. You know, in the movies, had me learning catcher bottles, things like that. You know, I've always understood the game, and that's all I really had growing up was sports. So, yeah, it did show me kind of passive and, you know, things like that. But, you know, I always had a drive deep down inside of me to succeed no matter what. And, you know, I was determined. You know, it's not every day where I'm from. I don't take anything for granted, and I appreciate everything that's happened to me. And, you know, not every day somebody's had to, you know, gets a movie made about them. That's legendary. So everything's positive in my book. And, you know, just not just long ago, you know, I was struggling. I was struggling and needed help. So, you know, I don't, you know, hold anybody.
You're not mad at anybody.
No,
I'm not mad at it. Okay.
Not mad at the world. So it's all happy on my end. So, yeah.
I hear you. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and I'm speaking with Michael Orr. Yes, that Michael Orr of the Baltimore Ravens. He has a new book. It's called I Beat the Odds, From Homelessness to the Blind Side and Beyond. Yes, he's that Michael Orr who's depicted in The Blind Side, but Michael Orr tells us there's actually a lot more to the story than was depicted in the film and the best-selling book. Can I ask you, though, you do make a point over and over again in the book of saying, you know, you are not the only one. There are a lot of talented kids. There are a lot of kids who want out of the very difficult circumstances that are depicted in the movie and in the book and in your book. But why do you think you were able to get out of those circumstances when so many other kids are not?
You know, a lot of people, you know, they wish and they hope that this happens and hope good things happen to them and things like that. But, you know, as I was watching everybody else hope and wish, you know, I was going to, you know, I was determined to work hard. I understood then, you know, you couldn't be, you know, involved in the negative things. You couldn't be around negative people, you know, in order to, you know, get where you wanted to be. And, you know, I understood that then. And, you know, I wasn't going to hope and wish. I was going to put my foot down, work hard, and, you know, listen to the people that I need to listen to and try and do all the right things and, you know, not get involved in the, you know, negative things around me like doing drugs and being with the wrong crowd, things like that. So,
well, your circumstances are certainly unique in the sense that you come from a situation where, as you point out, a lot of kids are in, you know, your mom, who you make very clear that you loved and you feel did the best she could with what she had, but she was addicted and she was very unreliable as a parent, and she even realized that she couldn't take care of her children. You said at one point you think maybe she was even the one who called protective services when she realized she could not take care of her children. On the other hand, it is a very unique set of circumstances for a family as wealthy as the Tuohys to get in your corner and to have to be as athletically gifted as you are. Is there some word of wisdom you think that's there for people who don't have those advantages but who are struggling as you were struggling?
You know, I just always tell people that, you know, if you want to do it, you don't necessarily have to play football, and God gave me the ability to be athletic and things like that. But, you know, it's plenty of other opportunities, you know, teachers, lawyers, any of thousands of more jobs out there for you. And if you want to do it, you can do it. And just never let anybody tell you you can't, because I was in one of the worst situations that you can be in. And, And, you know, I made it out. And you know, a lot of people, they have the parents, they have the resources to, you know, make it in life, but, you know, they don't take advantage. And, you know, that's the thing you have to do is take advantage.
You do talk a lot about foster care, and it was a big part of your life and those of your siblings. And you are explicit in urging people to take more of an interest in the foster care system. What would you like people to draw from your experience? What do you want people to get from the book?
I just, you know, want to open people's eyes and just let people know that if you do reach out and if you do open your hearts and just think about the people that need help, you know, it'll, you know, open so many doors for so many people like me or just everybody who's going through something. I talked a lot about the foster care, the 500,000 kids in the foster care, just to make their transition, you know, a lot better, because a lot of people, you know, put tags on, you know, these kids and things like that. I was one of these kids, so I wanted, you know, something good for me. So just open your eyes and just to help the transition be a lot easier.
You know, you talk about in the book, as we said, going back to the beginning of the book, where you talk about the fact that you were hungry a lot and that sometimes there was enough to go around, but often there wasn't. And you always keep your refrigerator full. Now, what do you dream about now? You've accomplished so much. You've certainly accomplished financial security. You've certainly been able to get an education, which is something that, you know, people dream about. And certainly you're able to buy whatever you want to eat when you want it. What do you dream about now?
What did I dream about? Winning a Super Bowl. Yeah, I want to win a Super Bowl. But, you know, just continuing to be a role model and just being that positive influence that people look up to. So, you know, and just continue to open doors for a lot of people.
Well, if you get that ring, I hope you'll come down here and show it off.
I will. You'll be the first to see it.
I know I won't, but I don't care about being first. I just want to see it. I could be the 15th. I just want to see it. Michael Orr is an offensive tackle for the Baltimore Ravens. He collaborated with sports journalist Don Yeager on his new memoir, I Beat the Odds, From Homelessness to the Blind Side and Beyond. And he was with us from KWMU, our member station in St. Louis, Missouri. Michael Orr, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on today.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.